project managers. Have you ever felt like you should get that promotion or a better job? Start a business. Write that book. Have you ever felt you were made for more but didn't know where to start?
Welcome to the PM for the Masses podcast with your host, Caesar Abade.
Learn from the experts. Think outside the box. Have a voice. Network and be extraordinary.
PM for the Masses podcast.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome once again. My name is Caesar Abade, your host, and this show is your regular reminder that your career matters more than your job and that your life is a project and you are the manager. Whether you work for a company or just for yourself, your job stability is really just your ability to land your next gig. So join me in practicing intentional, planned, and value-adding relevance, starting right now. Today, we're going to talk about something that I read in a book a while back, and I've been looking for more information, and I found this other book, and I read, and it's great, and I invited the author to talk to us. Her name is Karen Martin. Karen provides lean transformation and business performance improvement support to industry, government, and the not-for-profit sector. Karen's understanding of operations design and business management stems from her experience building the operational infrastructure for several rapid growth operations that each grew into multi-billion dollar companies. She has provided support to organizations in a broad range of industries, including construction, distribution, energy, financial services, government, healthcare, insurance, manufacturing, military, publishing, research and development, and technology. She builds energy within work teams by helping them focus on organizations' key performance goals, faster delivery of higher quality products and services at lower cost, while at the same time building organization-wide problem-solving capabilities and boosting employee engagement. She's the author of The Outstanding Organization and co-author of Value Stream Mapping, How to Visualize Work and Align Leadership for Organizational Transformation, which is the book we're going to be talking about today. She's also the co-author of Kaizen Event Planner, Achieving Rapid Improvement in Office, Service, and Technical Environments, and Metrics-based process mapping, an Excel-based solution. Karen, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity, Caesar.
No, you're welcome. Thank you. And we had a couple conversations already about this, so make sure that we were aligned. But as I shared with you, I read value streaming or value stream the first time when I was reading a book called Project to Product, and I had the author here, Mick Karsten, a while back here on the show. And the way he described it was, it was brief, but it was really, really interesting. He keeps mentioning over and over again, and that set me on a quest to understand more about value streams and value stream mapping. And I came across your book, and I got it, and I read, and it's great. It's a great introduction, but it's not just an introduction. It's also it's very practical. You have examples and you make a good case for it. So I thought, let's talk to Karen. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for reading the book. And I am of all the different management approaches or practices that, you know, I've discovered and stumbled upon in the 20 blah, blah, blah years that I've been doing this, value stream thinking and value stream management is by far the most powerful concept I've learned. And I just am really excited to share it with you and your listeners.
Great. And I am a very visual person. So every time there is some sort of map, I'm all over it. I talk about mind mapping here in this podcast all the time. So this was really interesting. So let's take a step back now, because you have an extensive experience here with helping organizations reorganize and organize the value that they provide. And we're also going through some very turbulent times right now. So if I were a betting person, which sometimes I have been, I would say that organizations are going to come out of this with the need to focus. So what do you think is the number one problem that organizations face when it comes to focusing on what to work on?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and it's one I've pondered for many, many years working with so many different organizations. And I do think that there are a couple of reasons that are primary. And one of probably the key reason is lack of a really clear strategy. Because if you have a very clear strategy on where you want to go as an organization, it becomes much easier to look at the work that you do and decide, you know, which of the work's going well and meeting the needs of the customers and internal people and regulatory agencies and things like that, and which of those, you know, different value streams, as we call them, maybe are not performing at the level that the organization needs to have them performing. So the lack of tying the work to a strategy, I think, is a big gap. And one that we, you know, help clients recognize, first of all, recognize that it exists, and then to close it.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, in that context, what is value stream?
So value stream is, it's a series of interconnected processes, typically cross-functional, that connect together to deliver value to ultimately an external customer. So you can have a you can have some sort of a external customer that's a paying customer. You can have an external customer that is the direct beneficiary of something that someone else is paying for. You can have a customer where it's tax supported in the case of a government service. So it's delivering something of value to an external customer. And the thing that's interesting about value streams is that in order to design one well and to manage it, you have to have a kind of a fabricated beginning and an end, because in the world of work, there really is no definite beginning or definite end to most of the work that we do. It goes on and on in both directions. So you create these fence posts, as we call them, in order to be able to manage something and understand it and improve it. But it's all those interconnected processes, both support processes and the direct value producing processes that create a value stream.
Okay. I know what that means because I've seen the pictures and I read the book. But can you give maybe an example like a real life example of what a value stream would be?
Sure. Yeah. And if I could, I'll give two just because they're different. And I think it'll help, you know, listeners of all different sorts be able to see themselves in one or both of these. So one of them is in healthcare, since healthcare is so front and center right now. You know, from the time a physician requests some sort of a test to be done or some sort of a service to be provided, a surgery, whatever it might be, from the time that request is delivered all the way through to the patient experiencing that service, and then to the follow-on, perhaps including the billing for insurance or whatever it might be, that is one massive value stream. In the technology space, a value stream could be from the time there's some sort of a hand raising from some customer, and it could be an internal customer, by the way, saying, hey, we need to develop blah, blah, blah. We need this new application. We need a new server. You know, we need a new system. We need a new whatever it might be. We need to delivering on that need and everything in between. So software development, for example, it's a massive value stream, especially it's a very complex product that's being created. And it has many, many different people involved and functions involved and different, you know, gates that people go through in order to move to the next step and all those things. That's one massive value stream. So it's basically request to delivering on that request and, you know, anything you can think of that's like order to delivery, request to receipt, anything like that is a value stream.
Okay, great. So it's the flow of value, I guess. You know, when I think about this, and I was reading the book, because I'm an engineer by trade, right? So I think of systems and energy. if you think of a car, you know, you have a certain amount of fuel that is the total energy that you have on board, and how that fuel flows through the engine and from the gas tank and converts to, you know, kinetic motion, mm-hmm. Energy in the wheels. I see that as some sort of a model for what you're talking about. Am I far off?
Yeah. I mean, I like that a lot. I've never thought of it that way. And I think it's a great analogy that it's just this flow of energy or the lack thereof. I mean, that's the thing that's good about value stream analysis is that, you know, you can see so much more clearly in this visual format where the flow of work stops. And then you can more clearly see why it stops. And then you can know, you know, then you have some options of what to do about that. Can we go back for a second to defining value? Because this is a point that people get confused on a lot.
Please.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of times people say, well, value is what the customer is willing to pay for. And that is true. It's a good way to look at value. If a customer knew the incremental cost of a step in the process, and if they knew that that was adding to the purchase price, assuming they're a paying customer, would they value that step, knowing that it costs that amount of money and they were paying for that? That's the traditional way of defining value. It's a little more complex than that. There are a little more different aspects to value in the eyes of most customers. And one of them is, does it meet requirements? So in a way, it doesn't matter how much it costs if it doesn't meet requirements. And so it has to meet some sort of, customer requirements or needs that they've got. And then the other thing is, and a big thing that gets missed, especially in technology, is how does the customer feel? I know we're not supposed to talk about feelings in the work world, but how do they feel using it? I mean, when you talk about UX or customer experience, user experience, it's very, very explicitly about how a customer feels. It's technically what they experience while they're engaging with software or any kind of technology, but it's as a result of that, how they feel about it. That is value. So when you're looking at a value stream and analyzing, where the flow stops and what to do about it, it's important to remember not only the cost of that step or that process that's being done, but also how it affects the customer in terms of their feelings and their experience using the product, and also whether or not it meets the requirements.
Mm-hmm. Is this something we can measure? Like, this is how much value it's delivering at the end of the process?
You can. The challenge with measuring that through the eyes of a customer is that customers do differ. Mm-hmm. And they do differ in their perspectives on value. So, for example, I'm going to take it to a tangible product for a moment, a lamp. A lot of electrical products have a UL label on them, meaning that it's met the stamp of approval and it meets certain quality standards and it's not going to burn your house down. UL, sometimes customers want to see that label, and other customers, if it wasn't there, wouldn't care. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, it's required, pretty much now required, that all things go through UL testing and are able to have that label. When it comes to the customer, I'm not so sure the customer always values it. Same with GPS in a car. I mean, I kind of chuckle every time I look at cars and talk to people about cars, that GPS is even still a thing, because, I mean, everyone has it on their phone. Their phones connect to their speakers through Bluetooth. And it's an interesting cost to put into a car when I don't know anyone that uses their car GPS.
Right.
So it's just one of those things that you have to look at, what are people willing to pay for? What do they value and how do they feel using it?
So let me take a minute to talk about my favorite remote collaborating tool. It's called MindMeister, and it's a mind mapping application. MindMeister is a completely web-based mind mapping software that runs in any standard web browser. So the mind maps you create are saved automatically in the cloud, online, and can be accessed from anywhere. If you don't know what a mind map is, think of it as a free-flowing visual outline tool that can be used for anything you want. So I've been using MindMeister for 10 years now. It is by far my favorite tool for organizing my thoughts, for sharing my thoughts with my team, and also for collaborating with other people. So for example, it is a perfect tool for you to create a WBS, a work breakdown structure. It's beautifully laid out, it's all online, and it's a wonderful company. So aside from the web app, MindMeister also offers native mobile apps for iPhone, iPad, even Apple Watch and Android devices, which means that you can access, edit, and present your maps no matter where you are. MindMeister was made as intuitive and as fast as possible to ensure that you can fully concentrate on the creative task at hand. So there's no clutter, no friction, just your team and your ideas. And speaking of teams, unlike traditional mind mapping tools, MindMeister lets you brainstorm in real time with an unlimited number of users. So I do this all the time. I'll brainstorm something by myself using a mind map, and then I share that with my coworkers who are far away, and they hop in and they help me out with brainstorming and moving things around. It's really cool. And MindMeister has a special code that will give you a 10% discount for my audience. If you go to pmforthemasses.com/mindmap, pmforthemasses.com/mindmap. If you sign up for any of the paid accounts, you can put in the code MASSES, as in PM for the Masses, so MASSES, and you'll get 10% off. And you don't even need to upgrade to a paid plan, because MindMeister offers free plan that it's a bit limited, but you can try it out. And then if you like it and you want to upgrade, you can use that code. That's a great way for you to get started. And if you do upgrade, it's a great way to support this podcast. And also, you will let them know, the folks at MindMeister, that you heard about MindMeister here on the PM for the Masses podcast. So again, pmforthemasses.com/mindmap and enter the code MASSES for 10% off. Now back to the show. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's something that you would still have to define it, I guess, you know, what it is that you're trying to deliver. And but I guess that decision would be subjective. So
it is, unless mm-hmm. you have, you know, very clear, detailed feedback from customers. So I just launched a new company, a second company that's an online learning company. And one of the things that I do is I engage with every single customer that buys a course directly. I send them an email afterwards, even though we've got feedback forms and things like that. And I say, how was it? Was there anything clunky to you? Was there anything that you didn't understand and you wondered, like, where do I go next? Was there anything, like, I ask all the, I want to kick the tires hard, especially now because we just launched. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that you have to get that kind of detailed feedback. And again, back to my earlier point, all customers won't agree, but you can develop a product to meet the bulk of the needs and the bulk of the requirements and the bulk of the value through the eyes of a customer. You know, that's the best you can do is to, you know, you can't be all things to all people, but you can be a really great thing to a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. Perfect. So, yeah. Okay. So we define value, we defined the stream of this value across the organization. So what is then value stream mapping, which is the topic of the mm-hmm. book?
Yeah, so we actually fought with our publisher about the title. We did not want to call it value stream mapping, even though it's squarely about value stream mapping. And the reason why is that we've seen over the years, people get kind of hung up on the tool, the mapping technique, the method. And mapping is really just the means to the conversations and decisions that need to occur at a senior level in order to make the right improvements to the value stream. So it's a visual reflection of something that's hard to see so that you can make better decisions about what you need to do to better serve the customer. And that's why, you know, value stream mapping is not, it's just not about the map. It's about what you do with the information you get. The map to me is very much like a blueprint. If you're building a house, it's not about the blueprint. It's about the finished house and how well it functions for the people living inside of it. But you need a blueprint in order to know where you're going to put the walls and where you're going to allow access through a door and where you're not, and, you know, all those kinds of things. And if you change the plan, you have to change it on the blueprint so everybody can see how the process now works. And in this case, how a value stream now delivers value to customers. So that's the first thing I'll mention is that we didn't like that title at all. We wanted to call it value stream transformation or value stream thinking or value stream improvement or something like that.
Okay. All of those would be appropriate after reading the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is a you know, if we can do this in this audio format, what does a value stream map look like?
Okay, yeah, good question. We can do it in an audio format. So mm-hmm. a value stream map, think of a loop from request to receipt, order to delivery. Some people say cradle to grave, ring to ring. Sometimes, you know, ring like a cash register to, you know, ringing up the final bills and things like that. So there's all kinds of ways to think of it. So there's a loop. The customer is at the top, often the center, sometimes the top right of a map. And then there's an arrow that goes into a series of process blocks. Now, the difference between a value stream map and a process map is that a value stream is a series of processes and a process is a series of steps or tasks. So it's macro to micro. Value stream maps are macro view of a series of interconnected processes. So you've got this customer at the top. You've got, you know, an arrow pointing into the first process that usually it's a team that's responsible for a process versus an individual. Not always, but oftentimes it's a team. And then it goes to the next team and the next team, and then maybe back to team number two. And then it goes, you know, back and forth, but it's working linearly from left to right across the page. Or in the case of being in person, which someday we'll be back in person, right? You know, if you're in person, you have a big piece of white paper, rolled paper on the wall with post-its, and you're putting these post-its in sequential order based on the handoffs or the breaks in the timeline as work is flowing to the customer. Notice I didn't say value flowing to the customer. Mm-hmm. I said work flowing to the customer.
Right.
So the sequential nature of this, these processes that move from left to right across the map, and when you're looking at it visually, shows these, you know, series of handoffs to different functional areas that do the work. And at the very end, the arrow goes back up to the customer because you've now delivered some sort of product, some good, some service to that customer. So it's a loop. And then in the middle of those two sections, the customer and the process blocks, is the information flow. And this is what's often missing at the process level, especially. How does anyone know what to do, what they're supposed to do? How does information flow in and out of various IT systems or applications? How does that all go? And sometimes when you visualize that, it is a big spider's web. And it's often a big spider's web, which is sometimes the first place that we look at to streamline the information will then help streamline the work.
Okay. Great. This is a great explanation. So, excuse me. So, you touched on this right here and you talked about this in the book as well. Talk about handoffs and how, you know, a lot of times that is the bottleneck there. So it seems to me like the mapping of this, of the workflow, I guess, the workflow, it seems to go where it needs to go, regardless of how the organization is organized in terms of silos, right? So what is a difficulty that, you know, traditionally organized, you know, with organizations with a with different silos for different types of work, you know, accounting and tech and engineering, for example. We tend to look at organizations as if they were organized that way, but really they should be organized based on how the work flows from the customer through the value stream and back to the customer. So what are some of the conundrums there that you have found?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, a lot of traditional thinking carries forward into the future, and that's what we are dealing with, you know, organizations that are purely function-based. The customer, you know, let's take a car. A customer is not buying a steering wheel and then a set of tires, a transmission, some seats. You know, they're buying a car. And yet we organize organizations for the steering wheel, the tires, the seat. You know, this is, of course, metaphorical, but that's what we do. So a couple things happen. When you have, let me go back to mindsets and why traditional thinking has led us down this path of functional organization. Specialist versus generalist has been debated forever. And specialists have become, you know, over time, kind of the norm, when in fact, generalist thinking can sometimes create far better flow in an organization. And by specialists, I mean, you know, we've got this department, and then they pass to this department, then they pass to this department, and they do these specialist things. Every time you have a handoff, you are almost always introducing delays. Almost always. The only way to not introduce delays is if you have a true pull system where work is pulled through the system. It's a technical process design technique, or you've got people sitting around playing solitaire waiting for work to arrive. And that's not usually the case. So handoffs are necessary when you have either licensing issues where people are only licensed to do certain kinds of work, or you've got incredibly intense training requirements where only certain people can truly master the skill that's needed, or you've got some sort of a restriction in, you know, the kinds of work, like, you know, some people, if they in government, if they have classified status to do, you know, top secret work, then they may have to do work. There's those kinds of things. But then beyond that, you know, I say the world is your oyster. Rethink who is skilled or at least has the potential to learn how to do work and keep the work with that person to the degree it makes sense before you have to have a handoff to the next department, and only have handoffs when you have to move to a different skill set or a different license type or whatever it might be. That is the means, that is the best way to get flow, and it's also the best way to get high quality.
Okay, interesting. What are your thoughts on multidisciplinary teams where you have, you know, a team of six people and, you know, you have somebody from all different kinds of the org chart in that one
team? Love it.
Okay.
Love it. It's the way of the future and it's the way to go. You know, organizations that are really firmly structured on an organization chart sometimes balk at that idea that there's, you know, a team of these different functions together, because it's hard to wrap your mind around moving from a function-based leadership structure to a team-based or a value-based or a customer-based structure. But the way to do it that makes it pretty risk-free is to have the team have, you know, one person that's overseeing that team and their performance, but then have each functional area still have a relationship, whether you want to call it a dotted line on an org chart, or if it's something more informal, a relationship with a functional lead. So you can still have functional leaders to make sure that policy is being applied, you know, across the board, or standards are being applied across the board at the same level. Or, you know, if there is a unique customer need, that it's, you know, properly vetted and decided in the organization whether or not one team should operate one way while another team operates another way, or whether they shouldn't, you know. And so you can keep those controls in place to keep, you know, everyone from spinning off in different directions without having a function-based org chart.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and most of the folks listening right now, they are involved with project management, and this is going to resonate with them because a lot of the project teams are created temporarily, and, you know, folks are pulled from different different silos, different departments to work on this project, and, you know, project will have a project manager who doesn't have like an authority over the team, you know, to make hire and fire decisions, for example, or, typically the personnel who are being pulled into this team, they do report to a functional, team lead or manager. Basically they are on loan for this period of time. So it would be interesting to apply that model across the value stream and not just for temporary endeavors.
Yeah, you know, it would depend on what type of project management work they're doing, but most projects that, you know, have the project management structure around them are projects that are indeed serving one or more value streams. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it would be, in my view, actually irresponsible to not have a cross-functional team be the folks that are designing and testing and kicking the tires and then redesigning, you know, based on tests, you know, experiment results and things like that. It's a great way to make sure that you're actually serving the customer, especially if the customer has a voice on that team.
Great. On that same vein, what if I, as a project manager or whatever role I have within the company, what if I'm not in a position to make decisions about the entire organization? Can I apply some of this thinking within the realm of my influence?
Yes, it depends what you want to do and how much influence you have, right? However, so, you know, I'll say this, when we go into organizations who say, hey, come help us understand our value streams. Well, actually, they usually say, come help us map our value stream. And we're like, to what end? Why are you mapping the value stream? You know, we do see organizations, we call it wallpaper, you know, where there are value stream maps hanging, really pretty current state maps and really pretty future state maps. And when we, you know, see the date that they did those and ask, you know, how close they are to that future state, you know, it's like not very close. And that's just heartbreaking to see that. But you know, a value stream needs to, most value streams are high enough level that it really needs heavy involvement by senior leadership, because they need to this is strategy. This is not tactical improvement. This is strategic decisions being made about how value should flow to a customer. So if you get, you know, depending on the organization, the word manager can mean multiple things. But if you get a manager who's very close to the front lines as a working manager, that manager oftentimes has no idea what the overall market demands are and the complexity of the industry that's being served and the regulatory environment that they find themselves in. And so it's very difficult for that level of a person to make decisions at the value stream level. So, you know, a lot of people get confused about that and say, well, you know, the people that know the work are the people closest to the work. Absolutely. Totally agree with that. But the people who need to make strategic decisions are not the ones closest to the work. And so the value stream mapping exercise allows a strategic set of decisions to be made before the baton gets passed to people closer to the tactical needs, so that they can actually get improvement made quickly. What happens if you don't operate that way all too often is that people with the closer to the work being done are told to make improvements. They start making, you know, pretty good, what seemingly are good improvements, and senior leadership's like, whoa, 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 whoa. No, we're not going to do that. We're not moving this work to that area. We're not going to change. Like, you know, there, because there's never been a blueprint designed. So just like you can't have someone come into a house and decide to start moving the plumbing around without, you know, talking to the people that are actually overseeing the whole plumbing thing, you know, it's very difficult to make tactical improvement decisions unless leaders are agreed, at least theoretically agreed, and have consensus around the direction.
All right. So let's say I'm listening right now. I am like, wow, this sounds like exactly the type of thinking and change that my organization needs, but I don't have that power to implement this. What do you recommend as a first step?
Well, so I'm a big believer in starting with conversation and not getting too hung up on whether you get someone to say yes right away or not. You know, people come, like especially senior leaders, come to ideas from all different sorts of perspectives, and it takes some savvy sales skills, influencing skills, to help a leader, A, be open to considering a new way of thinking, and then B, to decide to go ahead and experiment in an area. So that, I love the concept of experimentation. And when, you know, we find ourselves having resistance from a leader about doing value stream work, you know, one of the first things we'll say in a very gentle way is, why would you not? Why would you not try it? You know, if performance isn't where you want it today, what do you fear will happen if you try to think and design through a value stream lens? What could possibly happen? And then hear that, because, I mean, there's some reason behind the resistance, and see what that fear is really about, or those concerns are really about. And then, you know, be able to show that the value stream work isn't going to necessarily make that a reality because of the way that you'd responsibly approach value stream design. That's one thing. And then, you know, you could do value stream work at a mid-level. It doesn't have to be the senior most level in the organization. You can do it at a mid-level. But what I see all too often are people applying value stream thinking, or trying to apply value stream thinking and use the actual value stream map structure, at a process level. And that's not what it was intended to do, to be used for.
Great. And you're going more into more detail on that distinction in the book. I recommend everybody getting it. So the show notes for today's episode is pmforthemasses.com/127 for episode 127. And you'll find a link to the book there. And also I create a bit of a mind map for this conversation that you can check it out. There's links and some quotes and links for further reading as well, and a link also to buy the book. Just one final question, just to satisfy my own curiosity to see what your thoughts are. Regarding the world we live in right now, I think one of the things that came to light is the fragility of some of the lean implementations that we've had, especially when relying on foreign countries for some of the, you know, especially in industries, right? And when those things break, then we're caught without respirators, for example. At the same time, as the economy shrinks, there's a need for us to be more lean so we can use our resources better. What are your thoughts there? Like, is there a paradox here, or is just in my head?
So I just want to make sure I understand the question. Are you speaking specifically about the debate around offshoring, reshoring, onshoring, where products are produced?
I think that's what triggered that thought. Yeah.
Okay.
Because when, especially what you mentioned, pool systems, right? So basically we try not to operate on, by having, stocks of parts, for example.
Oh, wow. So at the risk of saying some really controversial things here, getting lots of email, I have very strong feelings about what should be done. And it's, pretty much in line with lean thinking.
Okay.
So I love global marketplace. I love global economy. I think that the more we're enmeshed with each other, the less risk of war, the better it is for people. I love the interconnection of a world. I am not a nationalist, and I think it's a very dangerous place to go. However, what happened, in my view, is we got kind of confused on when partnering with a foreign country in the supply chain specifically, when it makes sense and when it doesn't. So, we offshored all this stuff to, China, and then Poland is a big area, India to some degree, offshored all of this with the presumption that it was going to reduce cost because of labor. So it was a really kind of a very narrow reason to offshore initially. This is like the initial wave of offshoring. And what happened was we got product too far away from the customers, which might have been in the case of US. In the US, customers in the US, stuff's going all the way to China to get made, and it has to come all the way back from China to serve a customer in the US. In my view, and I think it's pretty aligned with lean thinking, what should be happening is we should be producing close to the customer. So if you've got customers in China, heck yeah, produce in China. You got customers in France, produce in France. You got customers in Lithuania, produce in Lithuania. But to have the supply chain located that far away is costly on multiple levels, and it is, we are seeing some of the effect of that right now. It's just too hard to pivot when you need mass production. So, that's the thing. But it is really sensible to operate close to the customer for multiple reasons. Customers differ in what their needs are and what their requirements are. And you have to know your customer really, really well to serve them well. So I hope that this whole situation we find ourselves in will cause a lot of really good rethinking. There's a lot of way to reduce expense especially in manufacturing, to do it here in the U.S. A lot of ways that you don't have to rely just on lower labor costs. So it's an important trigger. Hopefully, people will take it really seriously and rethink how we work on a global level.
Fantastic. And value stream mapping and thinking, in my point of view, helps with that tremendously, because you focus on what's important, what to focus on in terms of effort and energy. And, just like with the engineering model that I have, the closer you are to the energy that you want to create, right? That's why electric cars are so efficient, because right. Electricity is powering the wheel. That makes sense. So that's great. So thank you so much for that. I don't think that's controversial at all. It's very sensible.
We'll see. one more thing, just one quick thing.
Yes.
The one time that I think offshoring makes a whole lot of sense, if you're not just getting to the customer, close to the customer, which I believe very much in. The other time it makes sense is when you need a 24-hour operation and you don't have maybe the people that are interested in doing that in the U.S. Or in any country for that matter. So I actually use someone in an Asian country for work that I can give to him when I'm going to bed. Mm-hmm. And by the time I wake up, it's done. And I think that is a way to keep the wheels moving in as long as you have good controls and good standards in place, the quality of the work doesn't need to suffer at all. So that's one use of offshoring that I think is a smart use, as long as quality is maintained.
Right. It also adds diversity and different thinking to your organization.
Absolutely. So. Yep.
Fantastic. Karen, thank you so much for your time. If people want to learn more about you, about what your work, about value stream and value stream mapping, value stream thinking, where should they go?
A couple places. So our main website is tkmg.com. We used to be called the Karen Martin Group, but then we became a firm that has lots of people. So tkmg.com. And what I would recommend the listeners consider, we have free webinars that were, you know, live at one point, now recorded and available there. There's one in particular that we talked about, the whole value stream versus processes. So if you go on to the tkmg.com/webinars, you can click on value stream mapping or value stream transformation. I forget what the filter is. And take a look at that, processes versus value streams. You know, how do you know when to use each? That's I think that's a pretty good webinar for understanding macro to micro and the levels of granularity in work. And then LinkedIn, you know, for all your listeners that are on LinkedIn, I love linking and saying hi. And so I'm Karen Martin OpEx. And then we have a new online learning academy that I just mentioned up at the top of the show. It's tkmgacademy.com. And we've launched our first 4 courses. And I just would invite people to check out our website. There's some samples that they can listen to there and see if they're interested.
Fantastic. And again, I'm going to have links to all these. If you go to pmforthemasses.com/127 for episode 127. Karen. Again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here today, and have a great rest of quarantine, I guess.
Yeah, thank you, Caesar. It's been really nice talking with you, and yeah, let's hope that we're able to start moving soon.
Thank you for listening to the PM for the Masses podcast. Tune in next week for more great ideas on how to manage your projects better and truly stand out in your industry. PMforthemasses.com.